The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Lower World Diaries. I first discovered Lower World Diaries about a year ago now with very thoughtful videos on YouTube and Odyssey. I don't think the YouTube channel is linked below, but the Odyssey channel is. And he's also on Twitter and Substack. So, Lower World Diaries is a very interesting name, first of all. Could you introduce yourself briefly to the audience, and then we'll get into deeper things?
Good evening, Woz. Thanks for having me on. I am an English essayist and video artist.
Excellent. And, would you describe yourself as of the dissident right, of the nationalist? How would you summarize your worldview?
Yeah, I think I definitely fit into that that space. I'm quite interested in all of the different categories of thought that are coming out of the various elements of this thing called the dissident right, whatever you want to call it. I wouldn't say I'm fully sort of committed to any particular aspect of it, but, you know, all of the main points to do with the ethnic concerns, migration, globalization, the sort of tearing down of all of our cultural history and all of the terrible things that are done to our daily lives. You know, I'm very much on board with pretty much what everyone else is saying about those sorts of things.
Yeah. Now, do you, if you don't want to answer this, just don't, but do you have an art college background?
I did A-level art. And then I didn't take it any further. I was very into music when I was at university and later on. And then I picked up some sort of, well, this concept of video synthesis is a lot of what I do in my videos, which is very much like making music with light. That just occurred to me one day and I worked out how to do it. And that's kind of what stimulated me to make the channel, because I thought I could do something interesting with that within this kind of social media space, which is providing all these opportunities to come up with new ways of representing things and talk about things.
Yeah, indeed. I had a similar sort of thing where YouTube provides that, or it did. And you think, well, what could I do in this? So I think the first obvious question is to ask, what do you mean by video synthesis? And could you explain that?
Yeah, so if anyone's seen any of my videos, I have a mixture of sort of footage I've recorded myself and then footage I've sampled from the internet, so sort of news camera, that sort of thing. And then there are these sort of patterned artworks which I insert into the videos as well. And you use synthesizers, don't you, Woz? Music synthesizers.
Oh, yes, yes.
So it's essentially the same process. You have a light oscillator rather than a sound oscillator, and you are trying to layer up the light waves in a harmonic way. And it's just sort of amazing. It brings forth all of these organic patterns if you harmonize it correctly. I mean, most of the time it's just chaos and you're trying to tame it, really. But yeah, it's almost like sort of visual music. And I found that very interesting, having used synthesizers for a long time and been interested in electronic music for a long time. It just seemed like a whole new world of possibility to create something that also kind of fits into my sort of ideas about the world as well.
Yeah, the reason I asked whether you had an art college background is simply because from your videos, one would think that. It seems like the work of someone who is not just creative in the trivial sense, but creative in the deeper, more thoughtful sense.
Well, it's very kind of you, Wes. I know you've you have an art background, don't you?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've always sort of done things in my own time. As I said, I spent sort of, I don't know, too many years in the sort of electronic music scene. So I would, you know, spend all day for months at a time sort of working on music. And I think that, you know, it's the discipline really that instills the sort of end product when it comes down to it, isn't it? It's not just the flash of inspiration. You've actually got to make the thing. So I would say that period of being obsessed with music is probably what gave me the ability to come up with this new sort of, well, I'm sure other people have done it, but yeah, what I'm doing basically.
I think what you're doing is quite unique. I think you should give yourself credit for that. I mean, that's not too much. It does seem like something. It's very meditative, might be the word. I'm not sure if that's quite the word, but to watch your videos is to, there's a sense of being enveloped in a whole thing. It's not just a voiceover speaking over disjointed footage. There's a sense of musicality about the whole thing, which can actually be a bit puzzling at first because it's not what one expects.
Yeah, I've been trying to tame it. I think some of the earlier things I made were a bit chaotic, but I do. I remember listening to a distributist video once where he was talking about the necessity for people on the right to create their own things rather than rely on things that were provided for them. And I think that was one of the main inspirations for me, that what if I just make everything, you know? And actually, I did finish a video today, so there'll be a new one out soon, which is 5 months down the line. But sometimes I think this is just insane. You know, I'm writing it, I'm narrating it, I'm doing all these visuals, going out on camera expeditions, and then doing sound design as well. But, you know, I love it. So
I can empathize. Does it matter to you that every part of it is created by you?
Yeah, I was thinking about that today when I was doing things, and I was saying, you know, if I had other people to do this, it would be a lot easier. But I don't think I would be able to allow someone else to do it because, I guess there's something in the completeness of it that really matters to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very much the same. It probably would seem like arrogance to someone who didn't know this kind of thing. That why do you have to be in total control? Why does it have to all come from you? But it's because it's your creation. That's why it has to be purely from you. It's a different thing. It's a different practice to do. To allow other people to collaborate, allow other people to do bits of it for you. That's fine. I'm not decrying that. But there's a special achievement and accomplishment and dignity in creating every single part of it yourself. This is what I do with Millennial. I mean, absolutely everything is created by me. So I know that I can be proud of it, you know.
Yeah,
whereas that would be contaminated, it would be diluted if other people had made the graphics, for example.
Yeah, I was blown away when I saw the back end of Millennial when I was communicating with you. But, you know, it speaks for itself because you've got your own totally unique style, which is recognizable instantly. And I think if you brought other people in, it could be quicker, you could create something new. But I think given the way things are with media, it would probably tend towards the norm. Whereas if you do just do everything, it will have its own unique quality, I would say.
Absolutely. That's the other thing, that doing it all yourself means that it's going to be unique. There's that chilling line in 1984 where O'Brien says today, no book is individually produced. Every book is made by a committee of people. It's just, I think anyone reading that line understands that that's scary, that's terrifying. There's something really bad and unhealthy and ominous about that. So the opposite extreme is what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I went to that art exhibition that Alexander Adams and Fen de Villiers and some other people were putting on, and I was really, really impressed with. I think Fen de Villiers and Alexander Adams have a very, very proper artistic training, and I think there's something amazing about being part of a tradition where you've got these skills passed down for hundreds of years in sculpture or painting, and you can see how they do have that unique quality to their work because they make it with their own hands, but they also have this traditional inheritance which enables them to make things which are on another level to, in my view, what I can make with a computer. But when working with a computer, I think by being a maniac and doing it all yourself, you do at least manage to acquire some of that uniqueness.
Absolutely. And the whole matter of AI comes in here, because I just, you know, if I could just say it, tell the thing, a locomotive train blue going across a snowy landscape, it would do it. And it probably would look much more sophisticated technically than what I've created. But it wouldn't be me. I wouldn't have created it. So, people kept saying to me, why don't you just use AI? Why don't you just do it this way? And yeah, it would be a lot easier, but it would be fake. I think it's, I can understand someone saying, well, that's very precious. But to me, it matters. And, you know, to some people, it won't matter. I think you've got to do what you can do. It's important not to overload yourself. You know, so for example, next year, it'll probably be simpler than this, because I don't want to spend 3.5 months doing it next year. So I probably won't be as ambitious, but it will be something that I've created myself again. But anyway, enough about me. We should really be talking about you. And so how would you say that you, because this is, I should have said at the start, this is your first time on Millennial. So a lot of people who are listening won't be familiar with you. So, and perhaps also in your videos, you're more elliptical about this than you could be in a direct interview. So how would you describe your political evolution? What did you come from? You said in your notes that you started off as a middle-of-the-road liberal type. Tell me about that. Tell me about your background, obviously without compromising anonymity or whatever.
Yes, my debut stream as well. So it's a bit like being substituted on in the World Cup or something like that. So that's what I feel like.
Thank you. You're doing well so far, for what it's worth.
The group stages, though, I think Morgoth's the final, isn't he?
Yes.
I think I would say I was basically, I think of it as sort of religiously liberal, the way that we're brought up. You know, I'm a sort of first blood millennial. So that, it is, it's like a religion. And I think I went and studied philosophy at university. And when I got there, I had a feeling that something was wrong. And I sort of gravitated to the metaphysics department because that was much more manly and analytical, whereas the ethics department was a disaster. You know, I was wrong all the time about everything. And I spent probably 10 years trying to resolve the contradictions in secular liberalism. And I was reading, someone said it so well recently, they said it was the midwit canon, right? You know, these sorts of books with Richard Dawkins, John Gray, that sort of people, those sorts of people, where they will question some of the conclusions of, or some of the outcomes of the liberal society, but they'll never question the foundations of the liberal society, right? It's kept within a very tight window for people who are probably a little bit above average intelligence. So I was reading these books and trying to work out how I could fix it all, you know, like how could I fix liberalism and make it all work? And over time, I started to develop, I think, a kind of naive account of traditionalism. So this idea of polarity and cycles and hierarchy started to come to me. And eventually I just realized that you couldn't resolve the contradictions in liberalism, and that the contradictions were probably fundamental to the way that the world is. And at that point, a kind of light switch went off. And I actually kind of dipped out of the world around 2011 when you know, I had a smartphone for about a year and a half and I thought it was rubbish. So I just got rid of it and I got rid of all my social media because I could see that this was going in a bad direction. So I didn't experience anything like the Great Awakening or your early days in the alt-right, that sort of thing. I was just working, getting my head down. And when the sort of Brexit thing came around, it was as if some of these ideas that I'd been thinking about were starting to be discussed in the mainstream, which was very exciting. And I came back politically, still probably a liberal, but with some sort of semi-based ideas. And then everything that happened subsequently just blew what remained of my liberal thinking out the window. And I also discovered that there was this amazing community of people on the right who were discussing these things and also knew about all these books, which basically described all of the traditional ideas I'd had in much more refined detail. And since then, you know, it's been, there's a sort of journey within that, you know, where you go through this phase where it's quite traumatic to have given up your beliefs. It is like being a sort of a heretic, I think, more than a intellectual thing. But yeah, now I'm in a much more sort of relaxed space. Obviously, I'm making things that I think are good, and I've been through the despair phase, shall we say. I'm feeling positive and looking to the future and thinking, you know, how are we going to start winning, basically?
Before we get to that, I want to sort of focus on that phase where you felt like a heretic. How did that manifest? I mean, did you talk about these ideas with friends and find that they reacted badly, or did you keep it to yourself? Was that a shameful secret? Could you talk about that? Because a lot of people identify with this.
Yeah, I think it's a fairly common story. I've spoken to quite a lot of people now. Basically, I just sort of announced that I'd worked everything out. You know, I'm sure other people have done that. And because I really thought I had, you know, I thought this is brilliant. I've actually invented this entirely new worldview, which resolves everything. And yeah, I mean, it's not so much that people reacted badly, but they were just kind of baffled. And no, I've got amazing friends. Like, I'm really, really lucky, who are broadly liberal. You know, there's no problem there at all. But yeah, they're just kind of baffled and they're doing their own thing. And they didn't really massively engage with what I was saying. I probably wasn't putting it across in the best way either. You know, as I said, there's a kind of despair phase where you realize that you are a heretic. You know, I would say I had a religious feeling before I had a political feeling about all of this. And also I would be very jokey in the way that I was expressing myself, which instantly makes your ideas less credible if you're constantly sort of undermining them with humor. So yeah, I think that was kind of what it was like to go through that heretical phase, I would say. Does that chime with you, with any experiences you have?
Definitely. I mean, I fell out with, and I didn't mean to, and I didn't want to, but my old friends from art college, probably between 2010 and 2015, I mean, some of them even stayed around after I started my channel and after they knew about it, they heard about it. One of them discovered it by accident. And some of them, they still stuck around. But then I guess it was really when I was doxxed in 2017 that the last of them just cut ties, which I guess is significant. It's interesting. It's like that meant that I was now just untouchable, I suppose. Then there was one who remained from before art college, from school. And then he heard, and this is actually bad on my own part. I mentioned him obliquely in a video, several videos. And he's a normie. He's a sort of indie, rocker type normie. And I mentioned him in several videos in a critical way. You know, I was criticizing his beliefs. And he happened to see one of these videos and be very hurt. And so he cut ties as well. Now, in that case, I can't altogether blame him because he was personally hurt. But I hadn't said this stuff to him, and I certainly hadn't identified him in the video. I would never do that. But when he discovered what I thought about his worldview, yeah, he was hurt, so he cut ties. But he was the last one, and he, as I say, he was from school. the art college friends had all drifted away, and especially after the doxing. I think it becomes a drag for both sides, because you don't want to shock them and hurt them. And meantime, they are sort of disgusted by you. And they don't know what to say to you anymore. They don't identify with you anymore. They feel that you've become a different person. And meantime, you think that they've remained in kindergarten. So it's difficult for you to respect them. So it's, you know, I mean, I'm impressed by some people who are able to remain on good terms with their previous friends. And there are people who do it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't envy at all, like, you guys who were, as I say, I was literally just not engaged in the internet at all throughout this really dangerous period where the whole sort of all of the rules of social engagement changed. They had this massively insane new kind of political worldview dominating things, and you guys were in there dealing with that. I would have got myself in so much trouble if I was using social media between 2012 and 2015, I think. I would have probably alienated a lot of people and caused myself, you know, no end of trouble. So I've been very lucky to be able to see the kind of first wave of people who had to work these things out as they happened and learn from, you know, the experiences that they had.
Yeah. I was on Facebook during that time. And that was mostly just arguing with people, and also using Facebook to as a soapbox, when it wasn't really appropriate. But that was because I didn't have any other outlet to, you know, vent my frustrations. So I made those mistakes, those sort of beginner, the first era mistakes of social media. Mm. And as I say, people drifted away. But someone's pointed out in the chat, friends drift apart even when you don't have political differences. That's definitely true. But I think what we're talking about here is that friends drift apart, in this case, only because of political differences, because everything is so hyper-politicized now. I mean, the left, liberals, basically regard our worldview as evil. So for them, it's like being in touch with it's like a medieval villager still remaining friendly with the witch, you know, the village witch. That's going to weigh heavily on you, and you're going to worry about the social implications on yourself of being seen to consort with evil. I think that's kind of the same psychological mechanism that's going on there in liberals today. They feel disgusted, but they also worry, what does it mean about me if I'm still friendly with him? So I don't like it, you know. That, I mean, falling out is never fun. Unless you're someone who enjoys conflict, but most healthy people don't. It's never fun, but over and above that, it does leave you isolated until and unless you make friends within the political arena.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely fallen out with people in the past, but not over politics. And I think, I guess that was part of growing up. You know, you make mistakes, you learn where your weaknesses are, and often, you know, they manifest themselves in situations like that. But yeah, I think, yeah, for ordinary people, an image just came in my head when you were talking, and it's almost like there's two hills and there's people throwing rocks at each other, you know, the really politicized left wingers, and they're on one hill and we're on the other hill. And the people in the middle are sort of watching these rocks fly overhead and trying to ascertain how not to get hit, I suppose.
There was a quote from Eric Hoffer, very similar to that, something about history is made by the best and the worst over the heads of the mediocre. something like that. So, okay, well, I guess that brings us to your current work and the world as you see it today. So what concerns do you have I'm guessing that, I mean, I think you're probably, you probably have quite a unique perspective on this. So how would you say that, how did you discover the distant right, first of all?
Yeah, I've actually mused and mused and mused and thought, where did I actually get into it? I know the first stream I watched was an AA stream during the Copium Den era, the election, which was pretty funny. I remember that. I remember being, you know, I was using YouTube to just look up how to make electronic music during that period, I suppose. And at some point it would have suggested me, you know, the bread tube people. I was watching that for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was kind of annoying, but at the same time, it was a sort of intellectual exercise. So I watched a bit of that, but yeah, I don't know who the first person I would have seen, what's his, you know, Sargon back in the sort of Brexit era when he was doing the UKIP stuff and he was out and about talking to people. So yeah, I think I've had a very normal sort of run through the more sort of, you know, like, or the less sort of intellectual or less sort of serious side of things, gradually ramping up to, I guess you get put in your box eventually, you know, you get sort of maneuvered into a group of people that you watch. But yeah, I mean, I think I've had a pretty sort of, what's the right word? A pretty sort of normal sort of ride through the various aspects of YouTube, and then ended up probably in the more sort of intellectual sort of nationalist side of things.
Okay. And why did you call yourself Lower World Diaries, or your channel? How did that name come about?
I was thinking about how I was going to do what I wanted to do. And I wanted it to have a kind of, I wanted it to be like a publicly sort of viewable record of my thinking and my development. So I called it a diary. You know, I wanted to start from a relatively humble position. And then I just think we are in the lower world, you know, and there is a higher world. I'm very, as I say, I always had these kind of traditionalist instincts. So, you know, I'm interested in Gwenon and Evola and that sort of thing. I've been working my way through Evola's books, and this idea of, you know, improving oneself on all levels, physically, psychologically, spiritually. I suppose that's been a long running theme in what I've been doing with my life. So I say we start in the lower world and we're attempting to climb to a sort of a higher position, you know?
Yes, of course. We enter the world knowing nothing and very confused. And then we tend to come up with some, or be given some certainties that we're very sure of. And then they fall apart in early adulthood. And then we have to come up with something more enduring.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of scary when you sort of, well, I mean, perhaps it wasn't for earlier generations because things were more stable. But what's happened since, you know, 2008 has been absolutely mental. The sort of the dustbin of old ideas is getting fuller and fuller and fuller. I think the last stream, the UK Column guys were saying, if you'd spoken to someone in 2019 even and said, like, in the next 4 years, this is all going to happen, they'd have said you were mad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've said that time and again over the last few years, that things seem to be speeding up, but they're also becoming more extreme. You know, whenever I see a clip from Ireland of a group of men being dumped in a village in the middle of the night with some, you know, refugee centre, and a bus shows up and just dumps them there, and then forevermore, they are now residents of that village. They are now as Irish as anyone else. They're completely accepted by the economic, the political infrastructure, and the people are just expected to accept them as well. Whenever I see that, I think this didn't happen, wouldn't have happened, couldn't have happened 15 years ago, or even 10 years ago. I think it. And certainly not 20 years ago. It would have been unthinkable. So we're absolutely in a different era now. And I think the crux event would be the 2015 migrant crisis. But then COVID as well changed people's expectations. It changed their perception of their relationship with the state. And so now you can, the state can get away with doing stuff like this, which is just incredible when you think about it. And I don't know, maybe liberals see that and just they don't see something incredible. But to me, it is. Every single time I see one of these clips, it's just, it's unbelievable to me.
I don't think they see it. I remember someone saying, Google image search for white family or white father on your computer, right? This was a thing a while ago, and I did the Google search, and you get just presented with, you know, black people or Muslims or mixed race couples with a black man and a white woman. And that was, my whole screen was just filled with that. And I thought, this is incredible. You know, what the hell's going on? And then I went to one of my friend's houses, who's a liberal. And I said, you've got to see this, you know, because I've been, you know, sort of discussing some of these things with him tentatively. And I got him to search for it, and he got a completely normal screen, just like normal white families on his screen. And that blew my mind. I thought, am I being shown this to demoralize me or to, try and radicalize me into doing something stupid because they know what I've been watching on YouTube? And is this guy being shown a completely different screen because he's just like, he's not interested in political stuff online. That's not what he uses the internet for. And so I don't know, like, obviously they're not searching it out, but like, obviously every day on Twitter, you're shown another horrible video of, you know, one of these people in Ireland who's a new Irish person committing some sort of violent act or wherever. But if you're not in that scene, I don't think you see it. Mm. And you know that if you talk about it, you're in trouble, right? So it's quite easy to ignore it.
Yeah, I think that's a distinguishing feature here, that we can't bring ourselves to just forget it, to forget what we've seen. Like, I think, as you say, the normie, the liberal, sees this, and if they do have misgivings about it, which some of them certainly will, they know that it's best if they just forget this. If they just forget that they saw this and get on with making the toast or phoning that friend or whatever, because it's just going to cause trouble. And it really would cause trouble internally and socially for them if they were to dwell on this at all. But this ability to just move on, to just forget something so significant, I just can't understand it.
Yeah, I think we should actually probably try and do a bit of that ourselves, because I think we are shown things. Maybe it's not even particularly malicious, but we are constantly shown these images. And it's quite demoralizing to see the same thing over and over again. You know, I actually think it's probably quite damaging to us as people and to what we're trying to do, to be constantly just seeing these horrible things happening.
I agree. This is why I don't seek it out. Mm. I mean, I'm on Twitter and Telegram, but I deliberately don't seek it out because I know how it will affect me when I see it. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I pretty much wrapped up what I was going to say. Yeah.
All right. So you mentioned earlier about solutions and ways forward, and you've just sort of given one there, which is don't dwell on the negative. I think that's a very important thing, because that's another thing, is that people tend to go through that phase, the black pill overdose, where they become obsessed with what's happening, and they start binge watching disaster porn, you know, and decline porn, and I understand why they do it, but I do think it's important to get through that phase. What would you say in terms of would you say that you're concerned with moving forwards and finding a way to deal with all of this in a personal way or politically, socially? What would you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very familiar to me, that phase. I've been through that, and I've met a couple of guys through this scene who I'm friends with in real life, and I think we've all recognized that we've been through it, and we're all, you know, it's great to meet people in person and to make real sort of world relationships. I think we're all expressing a desire to start taking the initiative and be positive. I mean, what I sort of see myself doing here with this channel is trying to concentrate the energy of this scene. We've got our guys in the trenches every day fighting on Twitter, which I don't envy that at all. We've got people knocking out live streams every week, like getting our ideas out there, spreading and not doing the sort of idea creation as well in quite a sort of rapid fire form. We've got people like you organizing these amazing events which bring everyone together, which I think is very, very important. And so I want to capture some of that energy in a very concentrated form and refine it down in a way that does justice to the huge amount of effort that our guys are putting in for very little reward and at great personal risk, it has to be said, and provide something that is beautiful and I don't want to make it sound like I'm doing something better than what everyone else is doing, but you see, like, I'm using my time to try and make something very condensed. And I see that as being part of an organic system, that you have some people who are doing things every day and you have some people who are doing things every week. And maybe I do something every, you know, I'd like to do things more often than I do, but I've been quite slow recently, making things which are more condensed, more sort of rarely. Because ultimately, you need an organic form to store energy. And if you want to have power, you have to start with a concentration of energy, right? In order to do anything, you need to have concentrated energy. So I see myself, you know, I'm sort of rambling slightly, but I see myself trying to embody this principle and fit into a broader scheme and give something back to all of the guys who are, you know, making this amazing effort every day.
Yeah, you're not rambling at all. Don't worry about that. You know, this is about you and your ideas. So don't feel that you have to give a very concise answer to every question, like I'm interrogating you. I certainly don't want you to feel that way. This is your time to talk. In your notes, you say a lot about energy and especially spiritual energy. I think a lot of people would... Well, not a lot of people, but some people would scoff at that. So why don't you talk about the importance of the spirit in an age like ours, very scientistic, very rationalistic. What is the importance of the spirit and why should we gather this energy?
Yeah, I mean, when I was studying at university, I was very interested in science. So I took as many... Out of the philosophy department, I took as many science modules as I could. You know, we have these electives in a British university. I think they'd be called something else, an American university. So I was relatively well versed in sort of particularly physics. I was interested in that. When I say spirit, I mean the essence of a thing, the sort of non-material aspect of a thing. I remember Semyagog said it brilliantly once. He said, when you have when you have an alcoholic drink, a spirit, right? It's almost like you've captured the sort of essence of that grape or grain, and that's the thing that intoxicates the matter or animates the matter, and somehow you've managed to capture that, and then you drink it, and you become intoxicated and animated by the spirit. So that's what I mean when I say that. I mean it in quite a rigorous way, I hope, and I sort of, I'm following on from the sort of traditional books that I've read. And to bring that back to scientists, it's really funny to talk to scientists because they are very scared of metaphysics, which deals with the non-material aspect of being. That's the study of that in essence. I actually have, I'm looking now, I've got my dictionary of philosophy that I bought when I was at university. I remember looking up metaphysics in that dictionary of philosophy because I was studying it. And it's like the most ridiculous apologetic thing in the world, right? This entry, it basically says a lot of people don't think metaphysics exists, right? That's how they choose to represent this absolutely critical aspect of philosophy that goes back thousands of years. Because I think scientists are embarrassed to have to deal with the idea that there actually are objects, you know? Like they're very keen to measure things. In my view, they more or less, what a scientist does is they come up with a range of values about the density and disposition of energy. That's kind of the end point for them. But they're forced to consider these separate entities within reality in order to even start thinking about things or doing the measurements. And they kind of brush it under the carpet, because ultimately when they're doing that, they are doing metaphysics. So yeah, like you said, we have this very scientistic worldview, which is embarrassed about half of being, in my view, and obsessed with the other half of being, which is the material, the quantitative to the qualitative. And I think that's probably one of the sort of crucial contradictions in liberalism that I was trying to work my way through when I was younger. And ultimately, returning to metaphysics after university through learning about traditionalism just awakened me to the existence of spirit as essence, as the thing that is intoxicating and animating in the world. You know, when you love someone, you love their spirit, right? They intoxicate you when you're around them, or when you're not around them, perhaps when you're away from them. And it's not just a spreadsheet full of numbers that that makes you fall in love with someone, right? It's something unique about them.
I don't think that anyone really experiences life as numbers and units and you know, categorical labels and whatever. People experience life in a very nebulous way and emotional and even, you could say, spiritual way. But then they convert that into, you know, a much more quantified manner, conception of things. I think they've always done that. I think it's what we have to do. It's being hard-headed in order to survive. You know, you can't afford to get mesmerized by that sunset or that forest or whatever, when, you know, the bear could leap out at any moment, and winter's coming and you've got to be warm for the winter. You've got to feed your family and so on. So it's understandable. But I think in our age, we've entirely lost sight of the fact that there is, that it's perfectly legitimate to witness life and the world in that way. So we now think of it as a sort of embarrassing silliness, at least in the intellect, you know, among intellectuals. Normal people are still allowed to think like that, because that's expected. But when it comes to the intellectual world, we're supposed to disparage and dismiss all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can take this in a sort of in a different direction as well. You know, it is that tier of people. You know, you mentioned Orwell earlier on, and he has that description of the inner party, the outer party, and then the proles, which he, from my understanding, he's heavily influenced by the elite theorists who had that same conception of how a society was organized. And it is that outer party layer which are the most dismissive of the idea of spirit, because ultimately they're the ones who are recruited to implement this you know, awful dissolving reign of quantity style destruction of everything around us, right? They're the people who have to implement all of that, and so they hate it. They absolutely hate any sort of suggestion of spirit, because were that to return, I imagine they'd be out of a job.
Well, yeah, the proles, I think, is 85% of the population in Airstrip 1. They're just basically left alone. They can get into whatever they want, do whatever they want, say whatever they want, almost. Because they don't matter to the system. They're no threat to the system whatsoever. The outer party are the middle class, the bureaucrats, the administrators, the technical workers, that kind of thing. And so for them, it's essential to keep them absolutely in line, and that's what Ingsoc does. It's the middle class who are targeted with absolutely endless, relentless social conditioning and mental conditioning. And I think you see the same now, really. But there is conditioning of the working class as well, for sure. But it's really targeted at the middle class, keeping them completely deracinated and gormless about anything deeper or more perennial, and basically keeping them happy with nonsense, with breadcrumbs.
Yeah, well, they're not happy though, are they? You know, they're
I say happy. You know the word.
Yeah. I suppose it's convincing them that they're happy. It's crazy. Yeah, the level of suffering that you know, obviously the working classes are put through a huge amount of suffering as well, and they're the ones who, by and large, have to deal with face to face with the worst sort of effects of all of these things which are being imposed on them brutally and illegitimately. But yeah, even the middle classes are they're starting to suffer pretty badly as well. But yeah, I mean, I guess they look down on the people that they are imposing all of these orders on from the sort of center of the regime, and they think, well, at least I'm not one of them, right?
Yeah, certainly. And I always wonder what those at the top of our society, what their view of spirituality is, because I suspect that they're actually quite airy, quite different from the attitude that they encourage in the public, I think.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know. I mean, there's all sorts of theories about various sort of disturbing occult practices. I think they, you know, you look at these kind of tech guys and these financial people, and there doesn't look to be a whole lot going on in that domain. I mean, really, you look at us, we are probably the ones, and not obviously, where there's lots of people in our side of things who are formerly religious, right? So they obviously have that passed down to them in a tradition, much in the way that I was talking about the artists earlier on. But even guys, you know, I don't know what your position is exactly, but I think some of the hardships that we've gone through in the last few years, and as I say, I came relatively late to the party, that has really coincided with me starting to have a much more confidence in talking about these sort of spiritual aspects of life, because I think it's been forged through suffering, you know. I don't want to talk about COVID too much because I think it's all been said, but that was a very emotional and traumatic period for me, and I'm sure for a lot of other people. And I feel like getting through that without succumbing to the things that were being imposed upon us has caused me to grow very much in that direction.
Are you religious? I mean, would you describe yourself as religious?
I mean, my position is that I'm a liberal apostate. You know, I do think that those formative years, what you're taught when you're that age, it can never be fully taken from you. And I've actually had some very interesting conversations with Christians who were brought up as Christians, then lapsed and had basically became liberals. And then when things got crazy in the last few years, they found themselves in the same position of me, of being an apostate from liberalism. But because they had that tradition to fall back on, they kind of just did it until it made sense again, right? I've heard several guys say, I just followed the discipline until I believed it, which I think's, you know, very admirable. You know, like, I think, as I said, I think I said earlier on, like the idea of sort of disciplining yourself through repeating things. I think I was talking about becoming artistically minded, say, you know, people could look at those guys and say, you're just making it up, right? You're just faking it till you make it. But I do think that's impressive. And yeah, so I don't really know what I am, but you know, I would say certainly that I believe in God. I believe that being has meaning. You know, if you're going to truly grapple with metaphysics, that is essentially a religious field in my view. So yeah, I'm a liberal apostate, I suppose. I'll just stick with that.
A lapsed liberal.
Lapsed liberal, that's it. That would have been a much better name for the title. It would be less of a mouthful.
No, I think the name Lower World Diaries is very nice. It's kind of poetic and mysterious. So what would you say the Distant Rite, would you have criticisms of it? I mean, where do you think it should be improving or expanding in the future? Do you have any ideas about that?
Well, as I say, I'm very focused on this personal... My next video that's coming out is the first time I've really approached a kind of positive... attempting to give some sort of positive ideas of action, which I think you have to earn your stripes a bit before you start telling people what to do on the internet, right? And it's quite tentative. I'm following a personal discipline of trying to become... You know, basically, like I said, try and concentrate energy, be better. You know, I'm going to the gym, I'm reading, whatever, you know, eating right, all that sort of thing. Making these things as best I can, making these videos and doing this writing. So I'm in quite an open mindset at the moment. As I say, I think that organic structure is critical to future success, because if you're going to concentrate energy, you need a form for that energy to be stored securely in. And an organic form is dynamic, and it's a very good place to hold energy rather than just letting it all rush away. It's a good way to aggregate energy, and it's a good way to express energy. You know, in my notes, I gave the example of a javelin thrower, right? He sort of, through his training and all of these things, and then through the run-up to the delivery of the javelin, and then the throwing of the javelin, he kind of puts all of his being through the point of that javelin and sends it into the heavens. So I kind of think that's what we're trying to do as a group. Now, there are people, obviously, you know, like if you spoke to a Christian or a pagan or a libertarian or an ethno-nationalist or something like that, they would have very clear ideas about what they want to do and oftentimes what they think everyone should do. Where I am at the moment, I think because we're so atomized, I think we're going to have to walk different paths to the same destination. And I don't know what that destination is going to look like. Obviously, if you're a Christian, you're going to say it's going to be Christian, right? Or if you're a pagan, you're going to say it's going to be pagan. So I'm really focusing on what are the basic principles that we can all use on a day-to-day basis and which can guide our more long-term thinking. And that's what I've settled on for the time being. Maybe as I go on, I'll have a clearer idea, but it is just, you know, concentrate energy so you can have power and try and fit into some structure bigger than yourself and try and, just look up, basically. Try and climb out of the lower world and get a little bit higher to the higher world, right?
Yes, definitely. I think it's extremely important to remember that. I mean, we talk about depressing topics an awful lot, and the state of the world today is abysmal, but it is, and therefore it's all the more important to keep your head above water. This is why I try to encourage people to do, you know, to get skills, to have a job. If you don't have a job, try to get into that, and all sorts of things. You know, talk, chat to people, and try to remain optimistic, or at least as optimistic as you need to be. I don't think that people should be, you know, dazed and driveling, but it is important to maintain strength just for yourself, but also for the people around you.
Yeah, and I think when you look very fundamentally at what we're dealing with, we are being dissolved. And you look at how the power structure works, it is this brutal, you know, quantitative, repulsive entropic force that's kind of just smashing everything and pushing everything apart. You know, I think it's operating on a cycle beyond the ethnic or racial or beyond the political. There are these grand cycles in being, and we happen to be on a sort of a downward curve at the moment. And so what's the opposite of that? I mean, the opposite of that is attraction. There is a principle of repulsion and there's a principle of attraction. And when I look around at what people who are trying to build things, they're trying to do, they're trying to grow, they're trying to Praise of Folly, you know, he was talking about the catabolic element of the regime, right? And the catabolic process is when form is basically broken down in order to release energy. And the opposite of that is the anabolic process, where energy is condensed into form. And I think all of us are trying to build things. You know, you hear that word all the time. We're trying to build, we're trying to grow, we're trying to get better, we're trying to create order, which ultimately is a hierarchy of forms. So we need to, you just said yourself, like, get a job, get some money, talk to people, like, go to the gym, because it makes you attractive. And I don't mean in just the sort of the dull, not dull, but, you know, just the sexual sense. You can
pick up some birds.
You should pick up some birds, probably, you know. But, yeah, no, I think just generally become an attractive person. And, you know, this sounds kind of woo, but, like, energy will attract to you if you do that. And one thing I think is, when you're walking around day to day, think of all the arguments you win with people who you never even talk to, right? If you just look confident and you've got a good haircut and you're well-dressed and you know you've put some work in, at least some work in that day that's going to make you a bit better tomorrow than you were when you woke up this morning. I think that is more valuable. You know, we talked earlier on about talking to people and them being scared by your ideas. You're probably better off just keeping your mouth shut and demonstrating that there's a better world out there that people could approach, or maybe you could lead people to, or something like that.
Yeah, rather than being explicit and frightening them off. I agree. I also think that it's a good idea just to set, it's better to set an example than to preach. And this is why people love like Henrik and Lana, for example, at Red Ice, because they don't just say, you know, get married and have a nice big family. They've actually done it. And there are other examples in the movement as well. I think that people really appreciate that because it shows them that it's not just a nice idea, it is actually possible. So I think this is tangible. And it's the same also in progress in your own life. I think that you can tell yourself everything you like, you know, when you're 20. But it's only when you've actually really have achieved it that you can really believe it. Because then it's actually real, and you know it's real. You know you can handle that sort of crisis. You can overcome that sort of obstacle, and so on. So I think this stuff is also very important to have tangible achievement. That goes for the individual. It also goes for us as a movement, and that gets us to one of your notes. You said, as opposition, we seek power. And that means we must concentrate, store, and exert energy. To do that, we must build an organic structure. The regime seeks to prevent this. And I think this is true. I mean, you can see this as soon as anyone starts organizing or creating something involving multiple people, an organization, they get crushed. One way or another, whether it's by the bank account is shut down, the police start harassing them, HMRC starts finding irregularities, or more likely, Hope Not Hate or some other arm of the state will begin bad-mouthing them, disgracing them, digging up dirt, and of course the media as well will assist in that. So this is what happens because the regime know that things coming together is very dangerous. And you can look at that at the biological level. Cells coming together means that something is being born. It means that something is on the way. Money being pulled in one place means that that's a concentration of financial energy. And people organizing means that an organization is being born. So it's obvious, it's common sense really, but it does operate along a consistent, by a consistent principle here. So what the regime is constantly trying to do is break things up and prevent things from sticking together. This is what feds are all about, of course.
Yeah, as I say, like the sort of broad theme of the regime, Todd gave such a great description of the sort of technical process of how it works and the problems it's going to face with energy. And Eugippius very, very good on the sort of political aspects of this. You know, what was he calling it? Like the blob or something like that. I mean, he had a really good word for the international sort of managerial structure. So it does actually, it has this catabolic quality. It breaks down things beneath it in order to gather energy quite frantically, I think. It's destroying quality in order to just get enough quantity to keep itself going for another day, right? That's kind of how it works. And then it sees things growing beneath it, and it obviously wants to stamp them out because they are threats to it. But at the same time, it's destroying all of the people who are required to operate this technical system, which is, I mean, it's basically just built a sort of care home, hasn't it? You know, it's very focused on providing gibs for people who are not necessarily that good at operating their own lives. And it legitimizes itself on the base. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Marine engineers. Yeah. 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 So it just handing out resources to people. And then the fact that it's handing out resources means that it's legitimate, because if it were to go away, then there'd be a huge problem. But yeah, you had this argument of the competency crisis, right? It's literally attacking the people that it needs to run this system. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be easy for us, because when we do try and concentrate energy, it will be after us straight away. But, you know, I think it's looking pretty ropey at the moment. And you know, as I say, I was able to see people who had to deal with the internet for the first time, you know, trying to work out what was happening. I feel like we've developed, firstly, some pretty good techniques for making sure that we aren't just shooting our mouths off and saying stupid things. But also, I think we've got, after all of the things that have happened for the last few years, it's plainly obvious that we've got right on our side. You know, we've been through the mill. We've suffered some pretty severe deprivations. And the regime's thrown an awful lot at us, and we're still here, you know. And yeah, things are looking pretty rough at the moment. But in order to get stronger, you have to go through these periods of strife and challenge. And you have to be really honest with yourself as well. You don't want to fall into despair. You don't want to start blaming it on everyone else. I mean, we've just got to do it, you know, like you've got to play it where it lies. And we've just got to get stronger and stronger. And eventually it will keel over. Maybe none of us will be around to see it, but I don't want to be on my deathbed saying, you know, oh, I'm really glad that I just sort of bent over and took it, right? I want to be the madman who had a dig.
I actually think most of us will be around to see it.
Well, I hope so, yeah.
I'm a, you could say, a hyper-optimist here, or however you want to phrase it, but maybe I'm not being realistic, but I don't think this has got 50 years left or 100 years left. Predictions are sort of dickish.
I have something
certain wankery in making a definite prediction, because I've got no idea when it's going to fall apart. But sorry, I interrupted you. You go.
Well, I've got this thing called the squash court hypothesis, where I imagine, are there two sort of chaps with double barreled names on a squash court in West London saying, you know, it's getting a bit dicey out there. Are we going to start listening to these, you know, dissident right guys on the internet? Because this isn't going to work much longer.
Exactly.
I mean, when I say talking about concentrating energy, like, we don't have to build it all ourselves necessarily, right? If that was happening, right? If there were meetings going on between CEOs saying, like, this isn't going to work, you could have whole segments of the economy coming over once they were confident enough. Like, you could have entire... yeah, sort of financial architecture and media architecture moving together. Not necessarily going to agree with everything we say, but it doesn't necessarily...
Agree with enough of what we... That's all we need.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't need
them
to be, you know, telling me how terrific my work always was and referencing some video from 2015.
All your art college friends coming back.
Yeah. I just need them to say, yeah, let's save the country. Because that's good enough.
That would be nice, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, so that we end on a note of optimism. I think that, as I say, I don't think it's got 50 years left, and I think that just comparing it with a few years ago is night and day, almost. I think during COVID, it was possible to think this system is extremely powerful, and it is, but it's not invincible. And they are, I mean, they're not the best people anymore. You know, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak, for God's sake. But then who would put them in charge? I mean, and as you've said, numerous things are going wrong. Almost everything is going wrong. And then America is weakening. Rivals to the West are emerging. Now, I don't like the idea of the West going down, but I do like the idea of the American regime, or you could say the Anglo, what we've got. I like the idea of that going down, because I think it's destroying everything that's of any meaning in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah, that's the sort of the trend. But as you say, it's incredible what's happened recently with some of these certain groups who seemed completely untouchable are now looking hysterical and really struggling. I mean, the Culture Dads had an amazing clip from their podcast recently where I think it was called like something sort of people can't cope with how crazy white people are. And they were just running through the history of, you know, oh, we're going to invent technology, and now we're just going to go to the moon, and now we're going to invade the whole world. Right? And actually, we sort of frame ourselves as these very stoic, normal people, but we are insane. you look at all of the stuff that's happened in the past. I don't think you can count us out just yet. You know, we put us under enough pressure, we'll do something crazy, you know, that we'll...
well, that's not fair, boss. But yeah, I know what you mean. There is bound to be a pushback. And that just seems to be on the way. But I also think that we are laying groundwork for people to put things back together again. I don't think, and again, maybe it's just because I'm not realistic enough, but to me it seems like what we're doing is important. I don't think that this is a broadcast that's just going out to a few thousand people and it won't have any import in the world. I think that at least collectively, everything that we're doing is having an effect. And I think, as other people have said, the changes going on just now in the broader, you know, social media politics sector, and even embryonically in the real political world of, you know, American politics, it does seem to indicate that our ideas have filtered around, and not in a terribly diluted form either.
No, it is quite amazing when you log on to Twitter and you see certain people saying certain things, don't you?
Yes. I mean, and I've said it before, I'll say it again. Stuff that's being said now, quite out in the open, would have been completely unthinkable in 2015. So that has to be progress, and it has to be seen as progress. And now you've got all this stuff going on in Israel. And I don't think that Israel is the only source of all this, but it's one of the key sources. And the others are sort of codependent upon it. So that, again, I think that can only help us. I mean, how can, like, for example, how can Hope Not Hate characterize you and me as haters when Israel is blowing up children? I'm sure they'll try. I'm sure they will do it. But it's just increasingly absurd, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, everyone can see it as well. It's desperate. I mean, you see how hysterical people are who are sort of very much invested in this sort of thing, but their words have no weight. And I think we've said it a few times that look at us. We don't get anything out of this, and we're putting ourselves, you know, anything material, and we're putting ourselves at risk, and investing a substantial amount of our lifetime's energy into this project because we think it's true and because we think we're right. And you have these, you know, these sort of outer party characters who really have no sort of personal investment. They're just there hoovering up a bit of status and a bit of money. And as things get worse and worse, people will look at them and just think, you guys are losers, you know, I imagine a few years ago, they'd have looked at us and said, you guys are losers. But how could you even listen to some of these people with the absurd stuff that they come out, as you say, with...
Look, I mean, when you've got the world falling apart and some conservative moron, some dullard is talking about the economy and, you know, exchange rates or whatever. I mean, you know, it's just not enough.
Yeah, I mean, weren't they saying in America last week that actually everything's getting cheaper, right? So there is no, like, oh, there is inflation, but actually your wages have risen, so everything's cheaper. it's full on sort of, that film they made, The Death of Stalin, where they were really sort of sending up the absurdity of the Soviet Union. I mean, you look at these press conferences and you think, God, what's going on inside that person that's actually having to say that stuff out loud in front of a room full of people?
Yeah, indeed. But also when the scope of what could be said and what could be discussed is so huge, and yet the conservative establishment stick to such a small arena of ideas. But that's what they've always done. I think it's very much a keeping people on the plantation operation. It has been for 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, they're just totally discredited. They are. The events of the last few years have revealed quite how traitorous the Tory party is, and I suppose the GOP in America as well. I mean, for younger people, there's just no coming back from that. They're so uncool and they're so repulsive as well in the way that they do it all. They're just sort of... I mean, Eugypius was giving a good description of the sort of physiognomy of the health ministers. But it is that they're sort of like creatures of the night, aren't they? Just up there, just lying through their teeth for a few coins or whatever, or a little bit of status in their job afterwards. We've always had this. I mean, you've written I haven't actually read your piece on Have I Got News For You yet, but I made a video which I was talking about this. This idea of incompetent leadership and the sort of perception of incompetence being a pretty sort of useful tool that has been deployed over the years, because we have an ostensibly democratic society. So the fact that the leaders are shit, it involves the public in that process because they voted for them. So it's kind of your fault. And at the same time, you get to feel superior to them because they're idiots, right? And you have these sort of creatures like Hislop making fun of them for you on television. But things have descended into a new level of kind of parody and corruption.
Parody, corruption, rottenness, blatant hypocrisy. The Have I Got News For You thing, I think it was 6 essays, and they were the only ones that I've put behind the paywall so far. On Substack, and they were, was it June, July? They went out, maybe August. And that I was proud of that. But just to go into what that was, because it's relevant to what we're saying, that was an attempt to analyze and really isolate and sort of label everything that has... Why is it that Have I Got News For You is now a hollow program, whereas in the 90s it felt not hollow? And having made that analysis, to what extent was that an illusion in the 90s, and it actually was hollow even then? Because it's a matter of a liberal elite. They were already in charge in the 90s. It's not like this started in 2005 or something. They've been in charge for decades and decades and decades. So I think in the 90s, it was really just the last mopping up of conservatism and small c conservatism in England, in Britain. And then in the 2000s, they were free to just be open that yet we are in charge. And it was formalized with the election of New Labour in 97. So they could be open. We're in charge now. This is our world. So now we are going to, well, it's not our ideas that are operating, which is true. You know, things like gay marriage coming in, multiculturalism, mass immigration, the Equalities Act. But then they can't apply the same scythe to those ideas that they did to the Conservative Party's ideas in the in the 80s and 90s, because it's on their, because it's their side. You know, it's the left who are in charge here and operating, implementing these laws. So Have I Got News For You could not be satirical about a worldview that it shared. But then when that worldview goes wrong, as it did almost immediately, that leaves Have I Got News For You as obvious hypocrites. And so then game becomes just to mock any alternative rather than defend the status quo, because you can't defend it anymore. All you can do is attack any alternative.
Yeah, they went through a phase where they were they're sort of blaming the Tories for adopting their ideas and showing that they don't work. And now they're they've moved on to just trying to sort of put out these little fires of people trying to come up with anything different to the system that they've always endorsed.
Yeah, and the hypocrisy of, you know, someone like Ian Hislop, it's just remarkable how much of a system shill he has become over the last 20 years. He always was, but especially over the last 20 years. Somebody put up a clip on Twitter of him from 2002 or 3 talking about Britain's relationship with the EU. And he was, quite anti-EU, and talking about the hypocrisy, the corruption there and all that. But then 13 years later, the Brexit referendum happens and he was vehemently against Britain leaving the EU and has lamented it ever since. I mean, we're now 7 years on from the Brexit referendum and he's been lamenting it ever since. So it's a very strange thing. It's like they're trying to hold on to a world that they had for a very short space of time, but it was perfection for them. Like the champagne socialist, his era was really the 2000s. The 2010s was an era when things spiraled out of, like, the wokery stuff was beyond him. It baffled him, but he had to go along with it. The alt-right, what he would call racism, white supremacy, that baffles and disgusts him. And then the rising global powers and the WEF and COVID stuff again baffles him, but he has to support it because ostensibly that's all his worldview. And even if it's authoritarian, well, so what? It's better than the alternative. It's always better than the alternative. So the champagne socialist, I guess, is an archetype that it still exists and it's still there and it will be for quite a long time, but it's a relic. It's a dinosaur that functioned in the 2000s and the 90s and the 80s. But as I say, was discredited almost the instant it gained power.
Yeah, I think it sort of circles back to something I mentioned quite early on, which was reading reading the Midwit canon, all these books that would criticize the consequences of the liberal society without ever threatening the underlying premises of it. And I guess that is just manifest physically in Ian Hislop. That's literally who he is. And he's just, and you know, he's an avatar for many, many people like that. It's not just him, but what's he going to do? He's just going to enjoy his money and snark his way towards his death, never once questioning the fact that everything he believes in has resulted in the catastrophe that has befallen the West since, well, you could go back as far as you want, Second World War, whatever. But sometimes. Sometimes when I'm a bit tired, I just have to go back and listen to Zero 7 records, you know, from sort of 2005 when everything was fine. It was just more Chiba and you just chilled out and life was just going to be a permanent middle class dinner party forever, right?
Yeah, yeah. Indeed, I was going to a pub in Mortlake. I lived in Mortlake at that time in 2005, and there was a pub that I always went to. It was before the smoking ban. And I went there every day, and I often remember it just as an example of a time, a moment, and it was sort of the calm before the 2010s. Before the Parliament expenses scandal, before the global financial crisis, and before Occupy, and then the 2010s. All of that, this moment, this pub that I used to go to was just like a cam before all of that, and the middle of the 2000s, which, as I've often said, was a sort of empty decade. There wasn't really much that happened. But yeah, it was as if it could go on forever. But then it was the same in 2019. It was as if that could go on forever, and it's not going to. The culture, in some senses, doesn't change, but in other senses, it changes very fast. And certainly, society and politics changes very fast. And as that 4chan text noted, right now it's going at a breakneck pace. The change in the world around us. So I don't blame anyone for being baffled, and I don't blame anyone for being demoralized, because the changes are so fast that you can hardly keep up with them. And it's almost a sort of default to just assume that, well, we're powerless and it's all gone downhill because of the volume of information that's coming in every day. But I think it's not hopeless, and I think things could easily change in our direction. I think they are changing in our direction, actually, especially over the last few months. And this isn't going to just end now. It's not going to be like this happened at the end of 2023, this Gaza thing happened, and then that was, but then it fell out of the news cycle and things went back to normal. I don't think they can go back to normal now. So yeah, I'm optimistic generally. I think there's going to be a lot of suffering, but I'm generally optimistic.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at any other historical period and you look at anyone who ever achieved anything, and they had to go through periods of suffering. That's how you develop experience and strength. And we, in fairness, we've lived through an incredibly soft era in spite of all of the things that have happened since 2008. I don't envy the guys in the generations below us who are coming of age now. They're going to have a much more difficult starting point, although they do have much better information than we had when we were younger. And yeah. I wasted quite a few years when things were easy. Looking back on it, obviously I had no idea, but I'm a much better man now than I was back then, having been through some pretty sort of trying times in the last few years. And I think a lot of people will get into the demoralization phase and then just decide it's not for them and go back to being a normie. But those of us who've kind of pierced through and are now, as I've said a couple of times, willing to put themselves at risk and suffer in order to do what they think is right and say what they think is true for basically no material reward. Yeah, it's obvious we're going to have an effect because everything is so shit above us. They're so obviously wrong, and they're just so obviously destroying everything that's beautiful and everything that has meaning in the world. It's clear that we're the ones with the mandate of heaven, I suppose you'd call it.
Yeah, I think that's true. One other point I would make, which is relevant to all of this, is that I think the hypocrisy, the fact that, to get back to Ian Hislop, who's not the only one, but he's a very good avatar for all of them. The utter hypocrisy of him, the inability of that man to deal with the world as it is and to be honest and to even to acknowledge things, let alone analyze and accept them, but even to acknowledge, like, what can he say about Rotherham? What can he say about even Donald Trump except to condemn him? But he can't look at why Donald Trump was popular and the legitimate reasons. All he can do is condemn and condemn and condemn. And then when it comes to something like Rotherham, all he can do is ignore and ignore and ignore. And so that places him, and by extension, all men like him, it places him in a position of impotence and redundancy, which I think must reflect. I think that must filter down. People must see that, that the people who are supposed to be in charge of our society and also commentating on our society really don't have anything left to say about the way our society actually is now. And that would seem to set the stage for radical change.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen clips from some of the hearings. I don't know precisely what they were, that went on up in Rotherham in the north of England. And it's harrowing seeing these working class families coming to the realization that all of the institutions that were there to protect them have basically thrown them under the bus. You know, I remember just very clearly seeing this guy just with his head in his hands. He's got a baseball cap on and he just, you know, looks like a sort of would work in a factory or something like that. And he just can't believe it that that these people have willfully let him down and allowed his daughter to be, you know, treated that way by these people. Yeah, and so a character like Hislop, I suppose, what does he do? He just has to kind of snark and do some pretzel logic in his own mind why that's fine, I suppose. He's got to tell himself that's fine, right? That's okay that happened.
Price worth paying for the status quo.
Yeah, for the incredible range of restaurants, right?
Yeah, indeed. Well, that justifies pretty much anything, obviously. Well, anyway, okay. This has been a great talk, so thank you very much. I've enjoyed this. Have we covered everything that you wanted to cover?
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. Yeah, I had no idea what would happen going into it, but I think it's been a really enjoyable conversation. And thanks to anyone who's listened as well.
Yeah, a lot of people have been listening on Odyssey, Telegram and Twitter. So, yeah, rest assured of that. And I think this has gone very well. So, yeah, excellent. Well, thank you very much. I'll be back in about half an hour with, let me see, who's... I always forget this. Myth of the 20th Century. We'll see how that goes. That'll probably be quite different. But in the meantime, this has been a very good debut on Millennial, a very good stream, and from a very interesting guy. So, Lower World Diaries, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you.
Excellent. I'll see you all soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. All aboard! Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word. We'll be right back.